Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is the Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun?
So these are the ropes, the tricks of the trade, the rules of the road.
No politics, no religion, none of the sudden dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. Our monthly All.net members forum will be live online remote an hour after the show. We'll be discussing how to counter influence operations with some of the best folks in the world. For details, sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's A-L-L.net. Coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel to Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, dot C-O. For more details on this and other upcoming events, go to thecybershow.co.
That was absolutely amazing.
Now on to our first presenting company. Romain, welcome back. How you doing?
Hey, thanks very much. Very good. And you?
I'm doing just great. Last time we were talking about different ways that companies monetize games. Yep. And you identified three ways. You know, one of them is obviously advertising. Another one is that people in the game pay for additional features for the game, skins or whatever. And the third one you mentioned was they can actually make money in the game by creating things in the game and selling them to other players. Yep. Is that basically right?
Exactly. And they've got the ownership of what they are creating in the game as well. Which is quite interesting.
So this is this third part of the model. This is part of what I'll call the new thing that Web3 is supposed to give you. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. And right now, you know, the Web3 games, today they are more, you know, on PC and a bit oriented for crypto-educated people. And what we do at AdvanWorks is really, you know, creating games that target absolutely everyone. And all the players, you know, most of them are on mobile and are not really, you know, tech-savvy, I would say, right? And our mission is really to make that mainstream.
So when we talk about games, I first played a computer game. It must have been in the 1970s. I mean, I guess, they didn't really come out until like 72 or 73 or something like that. But before that, actually, we played them in the 1960s, which starts to tell you how old I am. But they were on like these Radio Shack sold a computer. And one of the things they had was a game. It was probably, you know, written in 35 lines of BASIC or something.
Yeah.
Games now are way, way more sophisticated than that. And this idea of making money on the games in multiple dimensions is fascinating to me. Can you just tell me, besides the three ways that you're doing it, are there other ways that people make money on games? And can you just give me, what's the list of the other things people do?
Yeah, so the three ways we mentioned is really, on mobile, all games are freemium, right? There are pretty much no existing premium business on mobile. But on other platforms, you know, there are, I would say, the classical way, buying before playing. So yeah, that's the fourth.
Then there's another way that came to my mind as we were talking, and that's people buy hardware to play games. So things like the flight simulators and so forth, they buy hardware, play the games. And similarly, these days they buy gloves and other stuff or higher end cameras or higher end computers. So as a company in the space, you know, when we talk about monetizing things, you know, people think that's a bad word, but the truth is you can't continue to be in business and build great games if you don't find a way to make money out of it. Is that the basic problem?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, creating a game is more and more expensive. Every generation, of course. On mobile specifically, you know, mobile are able right now to generate graphics that are completely similar to what you can see on console today and on PC. And player really expect the best, right? That costs money, right?
Well, right. So now, another thing to note here is you're not like a local game company. You're global, right? I think you mentioned last show, you have people from 7 countries that are working on games now. So you're global, you're 24/7, I guess, people are doing stuff, running the platform and so forth. And then the other side of it is where you sell to. So next show, can we talk about the global picture here for gaming?
Oh yeah, for sure.
What do you think, Chris?
So I'm going to obsess more with that in-game monetization thing and throw in a Discworld reference for the Terry Pratchett fans out there, right? Making money you know, they have this great debate about, is it the gold standard bait? You know, is it the physical assets that make the wealth of the nation, or is it the activity of the people? We're getting to this stage where we've developed gaming, we've dealt with virtual presence so much. We have generations grown up with it. As I said earlier, my kids are a great example. You know, the virtual activity, virtual entities, you know, making money by doing things, you know, it's the effort expended creates the value. So these in-game markets, in games like we're talking about here with our guest today, and all of it, you know, the value of the virtual asset. I think it's just fascinating.
So when I look at, you know, one of the things here is Web3, right? So they're claiming that Web3 allows you to directly monetize. I don't really understand, first of all, why we need a Web3. In fact, I really don't understand what Web2 is any different than Web1. But I think it's about not the cryptocurrency, but the underlying technology of blockchain is what they seem to all be relying on. And I don't see where that has anything to do with anything. Do you?
Well, again, you know, all this time I spend looking at supply chain and DBOM and blockchains, distributed ledgers, right? You know, repositories have value and use. But, you know, and to your comments here, Web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 is just words, right? We're talking about, you know, combinations of technology and agreed standards and ways to do things. So we need that plumbing, that infrastructure. And fortunately, not all of us have to know exactly how all of it works, but there's enough people focusing on that, monetizing it in actual cryptocurrencies, you know, currencies that use these repositories. But again, it's not about that. It's about people's ability to trust that there is value in something, in this case, a virtual asset. And again, we're decades into this. I know I'm fixating on this part of this guest technology, but I think it has a lot to do with it, right? People are investing billions and billions of hours, their time, in these virtual spaces. And what they do is not just monetized to the venue itself.
It's right. There's the globalization aspects of it are also very interesting, because just like in the physical sword days, you get people who are, you know, specialists, you know, physical swords, we make sword after sword after sword, right? So in the virtual game, I'm an expert at getting, you know, a level 3 sword for game 23. And so I just do that all day, you know, just like somebody making a physical sword. And so maybe I get really efficient at it. I can do it in 2.5 hours and I'm living in Malaysia somewhere. And now you can, you know, it becomes a market for swords where it's very inexpensive to buy swords. But if you want gnomes are quite expensive, right? Because they're more difficult to make. But we have people in China that specialize in those. Is that where it's going to?
Well, I have to, you know, I mentioned Earth 2025, you know, in the 90s, you know, in the last segment, right? You know, so I have to say, this is fascinating that there was a group called 7 of 10, was that there'd be like the 7 of the top 10 had figured out a way to take down big players like me. When I was cruising along, I mentioned I figured it all out. I could win, you know, top 3 in all these bloody games. And we're coming to near the end, like a month or two left in the game. And I log in and I'm wiped out. Hundreds of small countries attacked me. And these 7 big countries, you know, when I was weak, took my prime player down. And I was contacted by an elderly lady in England who had partnered with a South Korean guy in Denmark and a Filipino teenager and figured it all out. And I basically followed their lead. But we set them up over those weeks and had this, you know, to our point, this globalized, you know, Ender's Game sort of attack.
Yeah, building global coalitions in the game space, yes, to defeat other global coalitions. Okay, so it's...
This is 20-something years ago, right? You know, so to your point...
No, I understand. The issue is, in my mind, is there any real-world value that comes out of this? Or is this just that we have so much human resource that we can't figure out what to do with, that we're just creating completely artificial value that does nothing else?
Well, no. Again, you can go back 100 years. That was the gold standard argument. No. The real value isn't this metal, right? I mean, the counter argument is that what is America worth? You know, how, if you wanted to go buy one America, how do you actually price that at, right? And the same way, all this.
Okay, but all that is in this metaverse, right? It's not in the real physical verse.
Well, the services.
I understand, but I want to get back to the basics, right? You have to drink water, you need to eat food, you need to breathe air, and none of this is contributing to this. And presumably that's because we're so good at air, water, and food and housing that we just don't need that anymore. And instead of going to that Star Trek vision of science and learning more about knowledge and love and all this stuff, we're going towards the, oh, let's play game.
Humans love to pick on ourselves, right? You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, there's so much porn on the internet. Well, it turns out people like sex, right? And games, thinking it's a thing. And, you know, but we can't trivialize that, you know, the beyond subsistence, having a roof and having food, you know, and not dying, you know, what is it? You know, what's being human? And I like this artfulness. It's creativity. That's what we'll keep doing.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, dot C-O.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. Well, now, on to our next company.
Oh, that hurts! Wait, I'm not numb!
Shut up. Open wide. Here I come!
Nathan from Enamel Pure, welcome back. How you doing?
No, I'm doing well.
Just so everybody remembers here, you guys use lasers to clean and harden teeth, and then you use the vision you generate while you're doing that to be able to help people straighten teeth. So let's talk about, number one, it's painless, right? As opposed to scraping my teeth. Is that right?
That's correct. We say sensationless because it's not only painless, you don't have the scraping sound, you know, hearing it. A lot of people don't like the sound of the drill as well. So you don't feel anything, you don't hear anything.
You don't get that, no smell, no nothing. Okay, so now I don't want to get into the technology of how this thing works. Not only would it bore me to tears, the audience would probably run away and go to some other radio show. You're talking about FDA clearance. FDA clearance, you know, for like things like drugs, it takes like 10 or 15 years unless it's a pandemic and you're doing COVID, and it costs like $50 million. But that's not the same with medical devices like this, is it?
That's correct. So for FDA clearance, we have to show we're safe and effective. The dental side of the FDA is much more relaxed. Because we're not putting anything in the body. We're not harming anybody in any way. And so it's typically a 4 to 6 month process that costs you somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000.
Oh, that's ridiculously inexpensive compared to $50 million. So, but it's 1,000 times as expensive and 100 times as long. Okay.
Well, we don't even do human trials for dentistry. For the FDA, we use extracted teeth. So extracted teeth, enamels are dead tissue. So whether it's in your mouth or out of your mouth, it has the same biological characteristics. So we just do bench trials, which are very simple, straightforward, and don't cost hardly anything.
Okay. Cost is an interesting question. So now the question is, what's the cost to the patient?
No additional cost, no change in cost to the patient at all. The system is twice as fast as what the dentist does today. So the dentist can see more patients per hour, and that's how they pay for the system. Also, as we talked, it's sensationless, including the hygienist doesn't, you know, hurt their wrists using the drill. And it's a lot more pleasant for the patients to get in and out of the chair without sensation twice as fast. It's a win-win for everybody. Even doing 3 patients cleanings instead of 2 per hour more than pays for the equipment in less than 12 months.
So better, faster, not cheaper.
Well, it's cheaper for the, not cheaper. It's the same price. Basically, your dental insurance payment is going to stay the same.
Oh, dental insurance. Yeah, for those that have dental insurance. For most of us, especially when you get older, you may note that dental insurance is not part of Medicare. Maybe it will be someday. But okay, so it's faster. It takes me less time, less pain, no sedatives or anything like that. And it takes pictures along the way, 3D pictures. So what are the 3D pictures used for?
Right. So we have a camera and a laser. And so the laser pulses cleaning the teeth. And in between the laser pulses, the camera flashes, taking pictures of the teeth. The pictures of the teeth are then stitched together to create a 3D image of the whole mouth, all 32 teeth. And then those images, that data is then processed through AI software to identify any problems or difficulties with your teeth, your bite, and as well, it's the same data is sold to clear aligner companies to orthodontic solutions.
Okay, so what you said in there somewhere is AI. Will you come back for the next show and we can talk a little bit about AI?
Sure, that'd be great.
Again, Nathan from Enamel Pure. Chris?
So while you missed the cheaper inside that, it's cheaper for the dentist. And that's the cheaper that makes it more profitable to be a dentist. You know, if you can see 50% more patients for cleanings, which are very, you know, probably the most common thing being done, then your profits go up. So it may be one of those better, faster, cheaper things, right? And thinking about this since last time, again, this is one of these things, it's very Bones from Star Trek. You know, I'm actually going to use a scalpel. I'm going to cut people open with a flint knife. No, I'm going to scrape teeth with stainless steel. What year is it? 2022? You know, it may just be time.
The other thing is taking these pictures, right? So when you think about what you could do with AI with these pictures, You talked about this last time. So the question is, you know, how far can you go with whatever that AI is? Is it learning or is it automated analysis of some other sort? What can you detect depending on the frequencies of the cameras and so forth? And, you know, can you detect things inside the teeth that are going wrong or things on the outside? So there's a, sort of a broad spectrum of what AI could do. And then across mouths, right? So one of the things about AI, about learning in AI in particular, is you can get statistics and maybe understand different things about how teeth grow, about what the preconditions are for teeth falling out, and all sorts of other things potentially with the AI. And the question I think is, how far can you go with that AI? What does it really get you? How does the interaction of the AI with the laser produce something, you know, in the future that we don't even understand yet?
Well, let me take the optimistic track on this. Let's assume they got the tech, you know, and it's time, and I don't really see any barriers. Assuming the tech works and it's profitable for the dentist, it's adopted, ends up being incremental and emergent, right? If it provides value now, you know, we're talking a startup company. This is not, you know, a massive medical device company with 500 researchers and engineers. But when you apply those, you know, assuming it now it catches on, you know, that this technology, this company or another company or some set of companies, you know, all of a sudden it's 5 or 10 years from now. And we have, you know, the incremental part of it, I'll take the word for it, that AI right now can stitch the pictures together, you know, make a model of the teeth, say, here's the teeth. And while it's doing something else, you're getting that data basically free. For the individual, that'd be fantastic. To your point, as we get farther down the road, now we've got millions and millions of these been done, right? And we can see changes in individuals over time and demographics and how do we get that data today? With a pencil.
It's not actually a pencil. They use a keyboard to type it in, but it's the same data. So there you go. All right. Yes. So let's see what happens next with these guys.
I agree.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Now, on to our first service provider.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
Ralph, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Fred.
So anything interesting and new happened in the get money business between when we last talked and now?
Well, you know, there's always new and interesting things. And once again, I think it's just the availability of funding from typical sources is really being slowed. So I think finding money in other places is going to be a key in the next couple of years.
So Ralph, you help people find funding faster, and you know they can get access to your information and get in contact with you through the cybershow.co website and click there to get access to you and contact you. But last time we were talking, you were talking about backward-looking money and forward-looking money and these other kinds of things, and there are lots of different instruments. Can you just sort of talk a little bit about what the dimensions are of funding?
Well, I mean, there's many different ways to capitalize different assets, but I'll just look at lines of credits. It's a lot of what we do is around cash flow right now.
When you say it's around cash flow, the fundamental problem with companies that are trying to grow, if you have a product, you're selling it, but you have to pay something to make it, or you have to pay your people to do it. The problem is the chicken and the egg. I don't have the cash to pay the people to make the stuff that people are ordering. And so they won't order it because I can't make it. So,
right.
So that's the cash flow problem. And that's the problem that factoring solves. But what else besides factoring solves that problem?
Well, there's also bank lines credit, which is where I was going to go with the kind of rear-facing funding source. Bank lines of credit aren't really made to help you grow exponentially because it's typically 10% of what you did last year in revenue. So if you're a $1 million company, you have $100,000 line of credit. If your receivables, you're building a product or a service, your widget, whatever, is $83,000 a month and it costs you maybe $60,000 to produce that, that's what you're using your line of credit to advance, make your payments, make your payroll.
But with 10%, you can't make it.
It's not made. It's not meant for you to grow.
You need 80% or something.
Right.
Like that
you need to advance against your growing AR. Sometimes, and it's a difference between a line of credit and factoring. Factoring is forward looking. Factoring isn't going to be based on 10% of last year. It's going to be based on your good accounts receivable, your invoices. So if you have $100,000 in invoices this month and it pays in 90 days, you can fund against that. If you have $250,000 the next month, once again, not paying for 90 days, you can also fund that. And then if you have $500,000 in the third month, nothing's paid back yet, but it's still going out for 90 days, you're able to put that out and fund again. So it allows for multiple times, it allows for a growing well above 10% of last year's revenue, because the whole goal of factoring is to get you from point A to point B, whatever your revenue is going to be. I've helped companies go from $4 million $1 million 1 year to $12 million by October the year after.
Okay. But that's great for companies that are doing a million or two or whatever per year. How about companies that didn't do anything last year, but now have a product, they have purchase orders in hand, but they still need the money to build it, or at least to, you know, they're going to run out of cash and crash and burn if something goes wrong.
Well, with a new company, the purchase order piece is trickier because that's more like a venture. If you're venture funding or angel funding, if no one's ever produced something and now they're going to say they're going to produce it because I have a purchase order. Typically, your factoring companies want to see the AR first. So you've made orders. They know you can produce, but they're more than willing. If you get your own business off the ground from PO to the first invoice, now they can fund your invoices and then they can look at your POs once a relationship is established.
Okay, invoices they can do. So that's factoring, which is one forward-looking. Are there other forward-looking ones out there?
Well, there are, because you can do, you know, angel funding or venture funding. So you can get other people to give you money and give up part of your company. What I typically think is you get, that's a balance and a mix. So sometimes you need that to start and get through your PO phase, but then you can plug in other forms of funding. And one of the things we try to advocate for, if we can find it, is using a multiple funding source approach where you can have certain things with other things, like an equipment line of credit, a factory line for growth, and maybe a line to buy a building or other equipment.
Yeah, and that's backed by the real estate. Okay, so mm-hmm. So we'll get to that next time we check, because we are running low on time. But the thing that you're talking about here is what we're starting to call financial engineering. Mm-hmm. So you're actually engineering the company's financing so that you optimize, or at least make more efficient, many of those things out.
Yeah.
So you're going to be back next time to talk more, right?
Sure will.
So Chris, what do you think?
Right. So this is the cyber show that you might ask, why are we talking about money? And I'll quote two of my favorite people. One I know in person, this great Stuart Phillips, who sagely notes that most companies fail because they run out of cash. And the great author, Terry Pratchett, you know, talking about the CLAC system, the analog in the Discworld series for the internet, and walks through the whole story of how these bunch of engineers make this really cool thing that they don't own anymore, right? Which goes bad. And this happens all the bloody time, right? So you can cyber things because you like to, but if you want to get serious about engineering the technology, you need to engineer the business as well. And cash is blood for business.
Fair enough. The other issue, of course, is that most cyber companies don't have these hard assets. So a lot of the companies we talk to, they're in an environment where they're building real things, physical things that people use. And those are places when it's hard to get angel and venture funding because they don't like to invest in inventory. Whereas factoring can invest in the creation of inventory as long as it's going to be selling pretty quickly. And this is one of the challenges, right? As we move from large inventory to just-in-time everything, the cyber dependency associated with just-in-time everything and the supply chain issues have, you know, wreaked havoc on companies that were doing it that way. So somehow the financial approach has to change, or we need to do something better to secure supply chain.
Right. Yeah. The you know, hack all the things. Right. It's a fun meme and so forth. But if you want to think about it, you want to be an engineer, a technician, you know, a builder, a developer, call it what you will. You need to look at all the systems, and financial systems are as much a part of this as anything. I'd like to say, right, you know, if you really care about security, just security, don't care about a dime, a dollar, or anything else, find a way to make it lower cost, increase productivity and so forth, and everyone will adopt.
Right. It's about the benefits, not the technology. Well, now on to our next company. Mark from Firebot, welcome back. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Anything interesting happened with your company since the last show?
Oh my God, what hasn't been happening interesting? We've talked to ServPro to build Firebot into their product line, where they repair 40,000 stovetop fires a year, the kitchens. So on the way out, what would it be? Ma'am, for $300, we can install a Firebot and never have to worry about another stovetop fire. Of course, they're going to sell them. Talk to the second in command, basically, of Amazon to build us into their Alexa smart home ecosystem with Ring doorbell and all that. So that should be pretty good for us. And a lot of good conversations with fire sprinkler companies. They're in all these apartment complexes, homes, and even though they have the sprinkler fire system, they can't cover the stovetops, and we can't. So we can prevent half of all fires in residential use without damage. And that's the key point.
My recollection is this is a heck of a big market, right? That is just the fire suppression just for the stovetops. So what do the numbers look like here?
All right. Well, every year, and this is from the National Fire Prevention Association, and they get a report from all the fire stations in the U.S., what type of fire was it? And there's 172,000 dispatches for stovetop fires. There's probably another million that occur that are self-extinguished by the occupants with varying amounts of damage and injury. So it's a huge, huge problem. I mean, I like to say man had a good idea. He invented fire. Then he had a not such a good idea. He brought it into the home to cook with.
So now, just the size of this market, is when I looked at your gee whiz on adui.co, I see the total addressable market's about $31 billion or so. Is that just for what Firebot does, or is that for the entire fire suppression? Is that worldwide or the U.S.?
That's just for Firebot. I mean, we would love every home in America.
Firebot in the U.S., right?
Yes. In the U.S., there's 140 million homes or kitchens in the U.S.
So you sell it to them once, but it doesn't last forever, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a 10-year life. We have 10-year on the battery, 10-year on the suppressant, and then you need to buy a refresh kit, and you can replace each of those for $60. And you're good for another 10 years.
All right. So basically, it's like $6 a year after you said it was $300 for each. So you buy it. So it's $30 plus $6 a year after 10 years. Okay. So it's got to be that this is going to save you more on insurance. You know, I have an alarm system in my house. I didn't have an alarm system until the insurance company told me that my insurance would be so much lower, it would pay for the alarm system and more. So it actually saves money to have the alarm system. So what is it with Firebot? What's the deal with insurance?
Well, you're going to get an average of 5 to 15% discount on your insurance premium. You will avoid having to pay a deductible, which in some cases for commercial insurance for apartment buildings or apartment complexes, I mean, they have a $50,000 to $100,000 deductible on their premium. So if they stop one fire, they'll immediately get their money back.
Interesting. All right. So the market isn't just for home use. It's for what, apartments and, you know, any multi-use retirement homes, yeah. anything else where they got lots of stuff. So when you talk about home fires, that doesn't include apartment fires and everything else, right?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, now you have a multiplier. If you have a fire in an apartment complex, not only would it do damage to that unit, but multiple or surrounding units.
So you have a solution for that as well. Will you stick around and join us for the next show?
Absolutely. Look forward to talking to you again, Fred.
I think, you know, the financial returns, and it's just like the alarm system on my house, right?
You know, sensors and systems and emergent properties, right? These are highly developed systems we're living inside of. And as we zoom in closer and closer, so that not, you know, a third of them aren't burning down once in 10 years because we're using coal and stovepipes, but, you know, a million a year, you know, assuming that's the right number, probably doesn't sound bad. You know, out of 140,000 or so, below 1%, but damn it, you know, near 1% houses catching, you know, having stove fires every year. So yeah, I want to know that. I want to see it in real time, whether it's my house or my neighborhood. I'd like to know that this is not happening all the time.
But it is happening all the time. And that's what you see truck rolls, right?
Right.
Because you see fire trucks. Half of all the fires in homes are stovetop fire. So every time you see a fire truck going to a house, that's a 50% chance that's from a stovetop fire.
Right. You know, sensors used systemically, you're getting the emergent properties of lower insurance rates, more desirable neighborhoods.
Yeah. But the other thing that's the big differentiator. So on boats, do you have anything that not just detects, but automatically reacts?
Yeah, not as such yet.
That's got to be the future, right?
All right. Yeah. So, you know, water cannons can be used to suppress fire and so forth. You know, also, you know, there's dangerous boaters, you know, pushing them away by spraying water out the sides of your boat. So you detect something coming at you at a dangerous vector. You know, turn on the cannons, you create an area around the boat that people don't want to go into.
Right? Do you think that's going to be automated so that your water cannons will automatically shoot at other boats when they detect them coming in a dangerous way?
Well, again, to be clear, not shoot at, you know, just create that zone around the boats. You know, give me 15 or 20 feet of a water, you know, spray bubble, and people will just tend to veer away from that and not be there. But
okay, so you think that that's one of the things that's so now this does happen in ships at sea, right? Because there's piracy.
Right.
And so they do have defenses for ships that include things like water cannons and other similar mechanisms, as well as, you know, guns and such and other defenses. So but now you're talking about malicious and stupid accidental. But how about other things that cause boats to fail? Engine failure, sure, wind and water. So what other things can truly be automated on boats for detect and respond?
So maneuvering on anchor. So a boat on anchor is subject to wakes caused by other boats. And if they come along in parallel, they can cause, you know, rocking and bad motion. So detecting wakes, which are, you know, using video cameras, create a detectable pattern on the water, calculating that that angle is one that would upset the, and turning on motors to rotate the boat, you know, so that it's taking those waves more effectively.
How about automated bilge pumps, which I would assume should be around everywhere, right?
Well, right.
But are those common in boats today, or that's a new tech for boats?
No, float switches on electric pumps, you know, again, cheap on Amazon, you know, put two in every place. Well, but the smart part of it, you know, is when you start pumping water into or out of hulls, because under bad weather, it might be nice to have some extra water.
But right, because it gives you more stability, yeah. All right, so actually moving towards controlling the quantity of bilge, more like what you do in a submarine, right?
Right, again, sensors deployed systemically, creating emergent properties. You know, a dumb sensor, which is just a float switch, is one thing. Smart sensors, when you're saying, I have these conditions, I want to do these things, and then measure the results.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Coming up on Tuesday, the 15th of November, our quarterly community summit for Angel to Exit will be live online remote starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For details, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, dot C-O. Well, now, on to our next company. Lakshmishan Gajanan from iZen. Welcome back. We talked at the last show about AI and learning and that kind of stuff that you do. But Lakshmish was doing most of the talking. I want to hear from Gajan. Really, in your mind, what was going on when you decided you wanted to start this?
You know, we come from a background of teachers. Our parents are teachers, primary school teachers. We are always very passionate about education. We really wanted to do something in education where we do good and do good to the whole world. Right.
So when you say do good for the whole world, you deliver courses online, is that right, over the internet?
Absolutely. We deliver courses online.
So you deliver courses online, which means anywhere in the world, I can take one of your courses, right? It just runs over the internet from whatever computer I have, right?
That's right.
And so this covers, what, a couple billion people, right?
I would say 3 billion.
Yeah, 3-4 billion, something like that.
Yeah.
What about the other 3 or 4 billion people in the world?
For, you know, who don't have internet access, we also have a solution for that. We have iGen Box, we call it.
Yeah, what does it do?
By using that box, e-learning can be offered to people anywhere in the world, anytime, without internet, without computer.
So when you say without internet, I understand that, but the iGen Box is a computer, right?
It's a basic computer, but you still need a device to see the course.
Yes, you need a screen.
Device. Yeah.
You put up a screen. All right, so you attach it to a screen and a keyboard or a mouse or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And then you have to get power, right? So a large portion of the people in the world have no electricity. So how do you get electricity to it?
We plan to actually have a device where you can recharge it, just like recharging batteries or recharging laptops. You can recharge this device like a lithium battery.
Yeah. So whatever you do to charge your other batteries. So people have cell phones all over the world, right? I mean, right. Some of the poorest places in the world, they have cell phones. Can you run the courses from your cell phone?
Absolutely. These e-learning courses, content could be displayed on a cell phone or on a device like display monitor or even TV.
All right. How about for a whole classroom of people? Suppose I have a classroom that's in the middle of Africa somewhere.
So this device, it is not simply one-to-one. One device can offer or can be connected to 20 different people, right? If there are 20 students in the class, using one box, you know, we can deliver courses to 20 students in the class.
Okay, so these boxes where you're delivering 20 students, let's say a textbook, right? Just a book on AI probably costs $100 or $125 for a textbook, right?
Correct.
So what does it cost to get one of your boxes?
You know, with the cost going up currently with the current situation in the world, right? The prices have gone up. In spite of that, you know, we can offer the boxes for the price between $150 to $175.
Yeah, all right. So it's very cost effective, especially for a classroom, right? I mean, if you're running a classroom of 20 students every hour and you had to pay even $200, right?
That's right.
Where you can probably afford to do that, right?
That's right.
So we don't have time to go into further details right now, but what I wanted to do was start to talk about the way people learn today versus the way they used to learn and how they might learn in the future. Are you going to be around for our next show?
Sure, right. Thank you.
So the point here is that they have a box. So they've implemented this whole learning management system and the content and the laboratories on a box that they can sell for $200. It'll support up to 20 simultaneous users. And if you don't have a computer, you only have a display screen and a mouse or something like that, you can still do the courses that way. So for rural and people with no money, this is a way to educate people that's far more cost effective, doesn't even require internet.
Well, you're filling in the gaps. rural broadband, rural electric? I mean, how do we get past, you know, we're all used to this idea that we all have broadband and fat, you know, high speed and access to everything. Not everyone does. Cell phones changed a lot of the developing world dramatically because you couldn't afford the infrastructure, much less the computers. So this same sort of democratization of education is.
So when people say democratization, I don't see how this is democratization. This is filling the undereducated, the underfunded, the disadvantaged people of the world, giving them the advantages of education that you and I and many others have had.
Well, yeah, technically correct or not, right? You know, this is, you know, the net benefit that we're all trying to get out of this, you know, is raising ourselves. Rising waters raise all boats.
All right, fair enough. You know, this is part of the inevitability curve, right?
Right. Quite often we say, well, you can't X, Y, Z because you need, you know, ABC. But if we're following these Moore's laws, and we are, right, at some point that ABC becomes small enough that now you can do X, Y, Z.
So you think this is just the time has come and somebody's going to do it?
Time has come and somebody's going to do it, yeah.
Well, now on to our next company.
This section of the show is brought to you by Chocolate.
Now all of your life you're told you gotta eat your veggies before you get any dessert. No sweets, no cakes, no candies or creams or pies or jello you can slurp. Now here's some kind advice to make your dinner nice if your mom will give you what you prefer. Just grab a piece of pie and you look her in the eye and this is what you say to her. Chocolate is a vegetable that comes from a bean that grows on a plant called a tree. It lives in the forest with its other tree brothers. Yes, chocolate is a vegetable, you see.
Alex, welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Has anything interesting happened between the last time we talked and now?
I have to say, not too much.
When we were talking last time, we were talking about seat controllers that started to go bad in Rolls Royces and in other cars and push the driver into the steering wheel or lay it back in the middle of the night, causing marital problems and so forth. So at some point you got into the game of what, rebuilding the computers or what did you start to do and how did that happen?
I was living in Key West, Florida at the time, and I watched 2 years of lectures at MIT and 2 years of lectures at Penn State, all on YouTube for free, and taught myself enough electrical engineering to redesign a computer that would at least move your power seat and mirrors without killing you.
So far, yours have not killed anybody?
As far as I know, yeah. No,
or at least nobody has come back after being killed and complained.
Nobody's back. You know, restores control of the seat and the mirrors, and a lot of happy people, a lot of happy customers.
So you said they were going bad after 10 years. As I recall, it's because the battery was leaking acid over them. So is that a problem you've cured or is that still a problem?
Well, our unit does not have memory, so we don't. Goes back. They use TTL logic.
Yeah. It's good stuff, right?
It's great stuff if you're launching a rocket into space or something, but we're moving a power seat. So I use CMOS, which is stable between 3 and 18 volts. And I figured in a Rolls Royce that struggles to hang on to 12, let's go with CMOS. It's a little more battle hardened. And, you know, so we really haven't had much trouble with it. It's pretty faithful stuff.
All right. So the batteries aren't leaking ass. Well, you don't need any batteries.
I don't need a battery for mine. We don't have memory. We sell a $500 unit and the original one was $2,400.
Fair enough. So it doesn't have memory. All right. So it's not quite as good as the original car seat.
But it will not kill you.
It will not kill you. All right. Well, there's a benefit. There's a benefit. You're sure it won't. So do you replace the motors too? Does this have to be a new motor? Do the motors die?
No, it's plug and play. It goes right into the existing system and it's a fairly easy swap.
All right. So you just created the molds. You studied the engineering. So now you didn't do this alone, right? Your father is also an electrical engineer and he helped. To develop the cybernetic systems, right?
Yeah, I would create a design and he would look at me and shake his head and say, are you kidding? And, you know, after about a year and a half of that, I finally started to figure out what I was doing. And I don't know, I think I came up with a few clever ways of getting around the problems that existed, and they seem to be fairly reliable.
So give me a sense, when you talk about the problems that exist, what kind of problems exist in trying to build new parts to replace old parts in cars where you can no longer get the part?
Interface, coming up with pins to plug connectors onto circuit boards, coming up with connectors that will interface with the connectors in the car. This 99% of this stuff is all proprietary, and they threw the molds away decades ago.
So you're creating custom molds to just for the connectors?
Some of them, I 3D print the connectors.
Okay, so all right, so now we're into a whole other world.
Okay, so yeah, so then I taught myself electrical or mechanical engineering, and you know, photography and 3D printing, and we're using resin printing. It's, there's so many materials available for it, and the resolution and quality is astounding.
So I want to talk a little bit about using 3D printers to replace, you know, old parts and so forth. So just walk us through, if you would. Not all of us are experts in 3D printing. Just give us a sense of what's involved here and being able to, first of all, how do you get the specs for that part so you can 3D print it?
I got out the calipers and started measuring, and with the help of Autodesk Fusion 360, I was able to draw these parts on my computer, and then you create a 3D model of it and export that to a slicing program that slices it into however thick of slices you want. I usually use about 50 microns, 0.05 of a millimeter, and there's an LCD screen, and it gets kind of complex, but a LCD screen masks off the shape of the part, and an ultraviolet strobe comes up through the bottom of the machine into a vat of liquid where there is a build plate submerged in it, and it prints one layer on the metal build plate, which then lifts up and comes back down and prints the next layer. And it does that for hours until it's finished.
So printing one little connector could take you how long?
I can print, I don't know. I'll bet I can print about 75 of these in 2 hours.
Oh, okay. So it takes 2 hours to do the print, but you print 75 simultaneously or something like that.
Right. That's the type of 3D printing that I'm doing is DLP. Yeah, SLA uses a laser, and it draws out each pixel for every layer, and it takes an awfully long time. But it doesn't matter if you're printing one part or 100. Each layer takes the same amount of time.
But will you come back next time and talk a little bit about the trials and tribulations of the rest of the manufacturing process in today's cyber world?
We can do that.
So, Chris, you gotta love Alex.
Right. Yeah. So 3D printing and CAD programs and small businesses, oh my.
And mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. So
it's, you know, look back at the 70s, you know, and the 80s, when I was a kid and a teenager, and this idea that everybody would have a computer. Well, what would you do with them? You know, and to our topic here, it's like everybody's going to get all cybery. What's going to, you know, everybody really? You know, I'm a mechanic. I'm a machinist. I'm making these little, yeah, all right. Well, there's 3D printing, and the files for that are those computer-rated design files that you make with the software, and all of a sudden you're a cyber person too.
Yeah, but it's just the amount. We talk about education with iZen, and this guy's, you know, going online and taking courses from universities that are available online. So it's cyber all the way down.
Right.
He's using computers to teach him how to use computers so he can build things, you know, that are computers that then he plugs into cars.
Well, and there's that gaming company we're talking about as well, right? You know, virtual, you know, so an item in a virtual world becomes an item in the physical world when you 3D print it. Now, which one was the original? Which one's the real one? That's the wrong kind of question.
So when you start to look at this, think in terms of, you know, Alex is not a young kid. He's been doing this for a long time. He took course after course after course for year after year after being a master mechanic for years, right? So right. This is sort of the verticalized Renaissance man. Think about the kids today. You know, if you're like 12 years old today and you're 3D printing and doing design work and all this stuff, what do you imagine that future could be like? How universal could you be? How much of this knowledge can you pick up? Is it so vast you can't get it all? Are we going to get down to some level of understanding that allows you to be that universal person who can very rapidly, with a little bit of technology, do almost anything?
Well, I think at the end there, you're getting pretty close to it. I think people will, you know, continue to be different, will specialize in things and whatnot in those areas, and will branch and change over time. The classic model of, oh, this kid's really, really smart or whatever, so therefore we'll put him on a track so that by the time he's in his 20s, you know, they've got, you know, these skills and they're going to be an engineer. Oh, great. Fast forward 35 years. life happened. What else? What next? You know, what did that enable you to do? So this is the emergent property side of it that excites me.
So I think what you're talking about is cyber science and engineering becoming almost like a uniform thing where the specialty you happen to take on might direct you in a particular direction on a particular day, week, month, or year. But over the course of your life, you'll have such a broad spectrum of understanding and such an intense capability of doing things that you'll be able to do hundreds of thousands of things that nobody could do today, that nobody's ever thought of today. And almost anybody will be able to do almost all of those things.
Right. And you can't tell exactly which ones they are. Right. You know, I love the picture of the Sagittarius A black hole at the center of our galaxy. Right? You look at the person who put that together and the effort, you know, around her, and you find out you can bolt things together. Now, obviously a very bright person with an amazing education and so forth, but didn't set off down that path, but that's where they ended up so far. Where do they go next?
Yeah. And we're getting older. Where are we going to go next? The mobility here issue is fantastic, right?
Right. Yeah. 57 years old, you can pick up a specialty, and with the life experience you have and a better time in your life to be doing things and so forth. Yeah. You may be from the mechanic to the physicist.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our monthly All.net members forum will be live online remote an hour after the show. We'll be discussing how to counter influence operations with some of the best folks in the world. For details, sign up to the mailing list at All.net. That's ALL.NET.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Now, under our next service provider.
To drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me.
Perry Peterson, welcome back. So I understand after you blew up that motor in Aurora, and at NRC, your job was something having to do with making sure that similar things didn't happen to nuclear facilities, right?
Yes, and put that into a regulatory guide called Reg Guide 5.71. Reg, as in regulatory.
All right. So as a former regulator, and there's an expression we used to use, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. Did you ever, as a regulator, feel that you were going to help them, or were you going to maybe not so much help them as support them?
I was going to help them, and they were actually asking for some help, which is an interesting thing. An industry looking for guidance from the regulator. And so we did our best. But it was the minimum requirement. We expected or hoped that the licensees would go beyond the minimum requirement in the regulatory guide.
Yeah, but they never did, right?
No, that usually becomes the maximum. And it's difficult to get budget and people to go beyond the minimum regulatory requirement.
So let's talk about cybersecurity and nuclear stuff, since we are the cyber show after all. So Fukushima. Now here's a case where, for one reason or another, it came to the point where they couldn't stay in the facility. And as a side effect associated with all the super security controls, when they had to leave the facility, they didn't have any way to transfer control outside of the facility. And so there was no control. So from a cybersecurity standpoint, isn't it sort of problematic in these sorts of cases?
It certainly can be. Fukushima is a case in point. But in the regulatory guide 5.71, there was some guidance on how to establish remote communications. But it's problematic because enabling sites to do that and giving them that ability to do that, it also introduces some additional attack surface, if you will, and opportunities for hackers.
So when you talk about that, you know, my vision of how to do this is, you know, those old movies where you have these big physical switches, you know, and you throw it and lightning would go between stuff. Pull down the big switch, and when you pull it down, you can no longer control the facility locally until you flip it back up and you have to leave, right? Alarm sound and everybody's evacuating and the last person out pulls the big switch. And then there's a physical wire going to a place that's 5 or 10 or however many miles away, where they can then take over control of the minimal stuff to keep the plant from melting down. And when it's safe again, you come back. So what's wrong with that kind of control? How does that introduce any additional attack surface?
Well, of course, it's in the details, right? It depends on exactly how that's done. And are there vulnerabilities along the way? Are there vulnerabilities in the endpoints? Are there any other ways to disrupt that, because sometimes it's not just the idea of hacking it or penetrating it or compromising it. Sometimes it's just stopping it. Like if somebody just cut that wire, then that would be a bad day.
Yeah, it would be a bad thing. But on the other hand, it's a much worse thing not to have the potential for the wire. So if somebody cut it, then that redundancy would be gone. But without that redundancy, you saw what happened, right?
Yes, yeah, indeed.
So you got to do the analysis. What you're saying is you actually have to think about what you're doing.
Yes. You have to think about what you're doing. That whole risk assessment, you've got to look at the whole picture. And this is a challenge for not just the nuclear industry, but a lot of critical infrastructure that are looking how they can comply with regulations or government mandates, but still make money.
Okay, so we'll talk about making money later, but will you come back again for the next show?
I sure will.
There, Chris, it just seems so clear, the problem that you and I and everybody else in cybersecurity faces all the time, right?
Well, it does circle around the drain, doesn't it, right? And it's, you know, we've made it so secure that something happened and now our security is working against us.
Yeah, well, that's one side of that game. And then the other side of that game is the part where only do the minimum. That is, whatever the requirement is, nobody will exceed the requirement.
Well, you know, and again, the artfulness of this all comes down to the details. And if it's a competitive thing, expecting people to spend more than their competitors and therefore having higher prices and price themselves out of business is unrealistic. You know, regulations are always the last effort. Anyway, we can't get things to happen organically. We have to regulate them, and they're not going to work as well as if the motivations lined up to get things done in the first place themselves.
Right. But do they ever align? I mean, in cybersecurity, my experience tells me that because of all the failures we're having, it is obvious that people are underdoing the job. And particularly the very large scale failures, apparently they're not considering things like risk aggregation and interdependencies and so forth. Having said that, I think that the people in cybersecurity have a tendency to always think you should do more, even when that's ridiculous.
Right. And you ask for that, and then you get pushback. Now you've not only not achieved your goal, you've made it worse.
Now, onto our next service provider.
Charles, welcome back.
Hi.
So, have you been doing anything interesting since we last talked?
I've experimented with alcohol stoves.
So, alcohol stoves, that seems like that's not within the realm of what we would call the cyber world. Is that correct?
No, it's the non-cyber world. It's called a grid down situation.
Am I incorrect to characterize you as a prepper?
I would never publicly admit to being anything like that.
Okay. However, you are, from your longtime Boy Scout-like world that you live in, certainly prepared, right?
Well, I'm living in Alaska for 45 years, where environmental conditions were sometimes what most people would consider extreme, like minus 65 below zero and no commercial power and living in a remote area. You have to take a different look at things if you want to stay alive.
And you desired to stay alive, so you did. So at one point you were living above the Arctic Circle, right?
Oh, no. I've traveled above the Arctic Circle, but the Yukon River in the area where I was near the Canadian border wasn't actually above the Arctic Circle.
Just close to it. Above the Arctic Circle is now 65 in the summer, right?
Oh, it's certainly hotter than that, yeah.
Okay. So things have changed. When we tell the kids today that you lived up in the northern part of Alaska and chopped wood to survive the winter, they're saying, yeah, so it wasn't quite as warm as Palm Beach, but it's not that tough, right? But at that time, it was cold up in northern Alaska, right?
It was colder than it is now, typically. And if you had a house for two people or three people to live in, a house meaning a really small dwelling like 600 square feet or 700 square feet, you might need several cords of wood as fuel to get through the winter. And a cord of wood is 4 by 4 by 8 feet of closely stacked pieces of wood.
And of course, if you didn't have that, you would have to get out your axe and get that.
Action saw.
So have you taken this view of the world to avoid the cyber part of the world, or are you still part of the cyber world?
Mostly as a user rather than as somebody pushing buttons.
So when you talk about that, you've done a lot of experiments associated with wireless technology, right?
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about some of the stuff you've been doing in the wireless realm?
What I tried to do in wireless, and one of the things that I did, which was design systems for large buildings, like say a 500,000 or 600,000 square foot building, like a hospital, is try to plan a system where people could get connections when they needed them and where they needed them around the building. And because of the nature of radio waves operating at the frequencies most widely in use at that time, which was about the frequency used in your microwave oven, 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz, those radio waves tend to get reflected and absorbed by everything in their environment. So predicting exactly what signal strength is going to be available where can be pretty difficult. And for my part in it, I used a combination of ray tracing and predictive software, as well as a lot of measurements in the building to relate those predictions and models to reality and the actual technology available.
When you say the predictive stuff, and the actual technology available, you actually created technologies to work in those places where it was difficult. Things like, slicing open long wire runs and creating, sort of unique types of antennas and other sorts of things to operate in those environments, right?
Well, certainly specifying and testing different types of antennas and the potential for shielding the antennas or shaping the fields that they could receive or where from. Before that turned out to be impractical, and I found that some of the books on the subject from major companies didn't appear to be correct in telling you how to do that. But eventually I got to a level of engineering books on the subject. This is, we're talking now about Wi-Fi, specified that in fact, when they designed those systems, designed the protocols that they had allowed for these situations, that they allowed for networks to coexist with an adjoining wall between them, and each one could hear the other, but still cooperate.
So you did protocol alterations to cause them to be able to interact properly, is that right?
No, but you have to understand what the protocols are to design signal levels so that they will operate correctly.
Okay, so you can turn the signal levels up and down so that they would operate at the right amplitude so as to interfere or not, right?
Right, and placement of antennas and the types of antennas and whether they were directional or not.
Okay, so now this goes into another realm that we want to talk about if you're willing to come back next time. Can you come back again?
Sure.
Charles is clearly operating at the lowest level, the electronics, the signal processing level of the cyber world, and obviously having to integrate that up the stack. And one of the interesting things about that, Chris, is the spectrum that we see here ranges from people who are, in the physics of what's going on through the people that are just designing applications and the whole range in between.
Well, and a couple of things I always think about with Charles, there were the Emanation Labs, we built together at Webster University. And I love that. And the whole marker of maturity in that. And we see things in cybersecurity coming out. It's like, somebody figures out how to hack the voltage going to the fan in a power supply in a computer to encode in audio the information they want to exfiltrate from that device. So there's emanating audio, RF frequencies, programmable logical controllers, in OT environments. There was a lovely little hack where you can control the voltage on that and now create radio frequency emanations from the PLCs to an antenna outside the physical location and get the data that way. And on the flip side of it, we start talking about Alaska and surviving winters, makes me think of, again, myself out on the water, right? So it's everything in between.
Yeah. And all these are sort of at Maslow's hierarchy in the low level. And as you move up into sort of the self-actualization and the whole social media thing, the diversity, the range of issues here. So one of the challenges in cybersecurity is that it's so broad a topic that it's almost unfathomable. And certainly you can't know everything about all of it. And one of the decisions I think that's starting to get made in corporations is what the coverage is for cybersecurity. Is cybersecurity really responsible for public relations because it has to be out on the internet dealing with blogs and social media? And is cybersecurity really at the physics level of implementing the network hardware because it has to deal with emanations and so forth? And what is the range and scope of this field? And it seems to me that the scope of it is unlimited at this point in time. And either that has to change, or you just have to say somehow, like medicine, it's all specialty. And so you have your general practitioner in cybersecurity who can, do some initial diagnosis and say, well, you need to see a network intrusion detection specialist for this disease. So you think this is something that just gets watched out over the course of time, or is this something that now is the time it has to get differentiated before we collapse under the weight of the complexity of the field?
I think it's a relatively near-term transition. And maybe I'm talking 5 or 10 years now, right?
And now for something completely different.
Kerry, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing well. Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. So what have you been doing lately?
I got involved with a company called Mavericks Renewables. That's a contracting operator type companies. It's bringing renewables to about $1 billion worth of projects, both industrial and real estate. And that offshoot of that was that they were very interested in my IP for my company, the signal processing and power management.
So you're going so deep, so fast, nobody's ever going to be able to keep up with you. So let's just start out with the first thing you were talking about. So you have $1 billion worth of, so describe it more precisely. What is this?
Well, Mavericks goes out and gets contracts to bring renewable power sources to projects, solar, biochar, battery, microgrids.
Wind.
They do wind. They do wind as well. Do hydro.
Geothermal.
They do geothermal. So they have about 27 partners that have innovation that brings whatever's needed to whatever the project is. A lot of it depends on where it's geographically located.
And they're in the construction side of the business, is that right?
They're more in the contracting side. They contract and then they own the excess power and sell it to, you know, the off takers. So they are just the contractor, and then they bring forward like a company like Duracell, Eaton, or Penseco, or some of their partners.
So what kind of projects do they work on?
Well, right now they're working on a project in Kansas, which is the first green industrial park. It's got about 10,000 acres. It's got about 100 miles worth of road in front of it. So they'll bring in a big solar farm. They'll bring in the biochar because there's tires that are in a landfill and that kind of stuff.
So they're actually cleaning up the environment from a lot of the historical waste, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Fantastic. Some other projects, because I know there are other projects that you're working on, and we'll talk about them over time, but are there other good examples for this company?
Well, there's going to be a contract soon for the Aspen School District to build affordable homes for the teachers. And with one of our partners, who's a 3D printing company, we bring all the power in and, you know, they do the building. So we're working on that.
So hang on. They're 3D printing buildings?
Homes and two-story townhomes. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So you know, yet another topic for us to talk about. Unfortunately, we don't have a 20-minute slot. We only have a few minutes at a time. So,
okay.
Will you come back for the next show and talk about some more of this stuff with us?
I would love to. Yes, of course.
How will Alex fix cars and marriages? Will Mark get insurance premiums lowered for his customers? Will Nathan's laser clean up in the dental business? How fast can Ralph get the money out? How many ways can Romaine's games be played? Will Eisen have good karma around the world? How will Perry deal with global nuclear cyber issues? How will the surveillance state cope with Charles? And what about Carrie and Hank? Find out next Wednesday on The Cyber Show.
So I hope you enjoyed the show today. Next week, we're going to have another show where we continue many of these conversations and introduce some new folks into the conversation. That's going to include discussions with Hank and a variety of other folks, and of course, continuing the sagas and stories of these companies.
A good times and bow.
We'll see you next week on The Cyber Show.
A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time.